Hello, everybody. Welcome to a new episode of the Dissenter. I'm your host, as always, Ricardo Lopes, and today I'm joined by Dr. Benson Anay. He is Professor of Philosophy and BOF Research Professor at the University of Antwerp, where he is also co-director of the Center for Philosophical Psychology. He is a cognitive scientist and philosopher of mind, working on perception, attention, mental imagery, and action, and he also works on topics in aesthetics. So, Dr. Nanei, welcome to the show. It's a pleasure to have you on.
Thanks, nice to be here.
So, let's start perhaps with just to contextualize things a little bit. What is the relationship between philosophy of mind and cognitive science? And perhaps you would like to comment a little bit more generally on how you look at the relationship between philosophy and science.
Good, that's a very important topic that I wish that philosophers were asking themselves the questions like this more often. In fact, I think that for any philosophy student, that's a really important question to ask themselves. So, why should we study philosophy of mind when we have psychology and neuroscience? What can philosophy of mind possibly, what kind of questions could philosophy of mind possibly respond to or answer that neuroscience and psychology can't? And it's not just about mind, right? It's about philosophy of language. Why do we need philosophy of language when we have linguistics? Why do we have philosophy of biology when we have biology? And there's various ways in which people try to answer these questions to say that, well, philosophy is normative, the sciences are descriptive, or philosophy is about necessary claims, and science is about the contingent. And I don't think that any of that really works. So I think that should really worry us philosophers, whether we have any justification to exist. And I think we do have a justification, at least in the case of philosophy of mind. I mean, I hope that there's a justification, and that is to somehow to contribute to the interdisciplinary effort of understanding the mind. So you mentioned cognitive science, and that's cognitive science is this discipline that was born in the late 70s, early 80s, by which time all the sciences of the mind were, advanced enough to have some nice body of knowledge and to be able to interact. So psychologists and neuroscientists and linguists and philosophers of mind, they were somehow trying to understand the mind together with different kinds of methodology. So, neuroscientists, what they do is they put you in a scanner and make you perform various tasks. Psychologists, they make you, push various buttons and measure the time, how long it takes for you to do that. What do we do? What do philosophers of mind do? And I think that one thing that we can do, I mean, we can do it very well, is to bring together different empirical subfields. So, cognitive science is an interdisciplinary endeavor. There's various different empirical fields in it. And they are, there's not, neuroscientists are busy with their experiments, and the psychologists are busy with their experiments. And they're not going to really have time to really dig deep about the other disciplines. But with philosophers, if anything, we have time. So we really are in a very good position to bring together bodies of knowledge from different empirical subdisciplines and see and by somehow uniting them into some kind of more higher level theory. That can be an important information for the specific empirical sciences. So the way I imagine the interaction between philosophy and science is some kind of two-directional interaction. So philosophy should be informed by the empirical sciences, but it should also be somehow relevant to the empirical sciences. And it can be relevant if it does somehow combine together and brings into unity different empirical subfields. So that's kind of a very long answer to the question, but I think that this is a really important question that people should ask themselves more.
So you think that, for example, one of the things that philosophers can do better than scientists, also because probably they don't have necessarily to be in the laboratory doing the experiments and they have more time to look across different fields, is that it's easier for them to look at the bigger picture.
Exactly. Well, us philosophers, we just hang out in cafes, right? So we don't have to go to lab and switch on machines. So we have, yeah, exactly. So that's one way of one really neat way of putting it, that we are in a position to look at the bigger picture. But it should be noted that the bigger picture, ideally, I think, the bigger picture should somehow emerge from the smaller picture of the empirical sciences.
And sometimes there's also experimental philosophy, correct? There are experimental philosophers.
Well, there's experimental philosophy. I take that to be a very different endeavor. So cognitive science is trying to understand how the mind works, and neuroscientists are trying to understand how the mind works, and psychologists are trying to understand how the mind works. I don't think experimental philosophy is trying to do that. So it's a bit of a kind of terminological potential confusion that maybe it's worth to clear up. So what experimental philosophers do is to walk up to people and ask them what they think about various things. And then they run various statistical analyses on those answers. So they ask people, is there free will? Or, that's kind of a silly question, but more specific question. So they give them a scenario and they ask you, so did Bill, who this little vignette was about, did he choose freely? And then they ask these questions from hundreds of people, and then they run statistical analysis and they come to certain conclusions. So no matter how you construe this, this kinds of research is not about how the mind works. It's about how people think the mind works, right? Mm-hmm. So they ask people questions about what they think about the mind, whether they have free will or something like that. So it's so I take experimental philosophy to be a slightly different endeavor, and it's been quite popular, and it's not a bad thing. At least it gives some statistics training to philosophers, which we can all use. But I do take that to be a separate project from what I'm engaging with, or so from general cognitive science project.
But in that context, do you think that knowing how people think about how the mind works is also informative about how the mind works or not?
Well, yeah, I think that is a big, huge step that experimental philosophers, they sometimes make, and I don't think that we should. So I think that we have very little insight into how our mind works. So asking me about, I don't know, how visual perception works is not going to give you very, going to the street and asking people how visual perception works, that's not going to give you a very neat account of how visual perception works. And there's a lot of research about just how unreliable introspection is, how unreliable it is when people just, close their eyes and think back about how their mind works. There's a lot of systematic unreliabilities. And I guess you could say that one thing that motivates experimental philosophy is that rather than relying on just one person's introspective evidence, when the philosopher in the armchair, they think that, is there twin Earth? How do things work on twin Earth? And they come up with some kind of conclusion. They ask a bunch of people to do the same thing. But in some sense, that's an improvement that somehow you can, there's some kind of aggregation of judgments. But in some other sense, it's not an improvement because you're still kind of in the realm of opinions or the introspective evidence, rather than kind of actually discussing how the mind works. So, right. And I could give you many examples from various subfields of empirical research about just how unreliable we are when we try to introspect.
Yes, but for example, just to pick up on the example of free will, as you gave. So, even if people's beliefs about free will don't tell us anything about the existence or not of free will, at least, perhaps we can learn something about the kinds of situations where people attribute more or less freedom to people's actions, and that would be informative about how our human psychology, for example, evolved.
Definitely. No, so I'm not saying that, and I have, when I was young and, needed the money, I did publish some experimental philosophy. So I'm not against that project. And I think it is definitely better than just listen to one dude in an armchair. But, and I think that the example that you use is nice. And let's go with an actual real example. So the paradigm that kicked out the whole experimental philosophy research project is about what action we perform intentionally, right? So that was this big, very celebrated experiment according to which if an action has a positive outcome, then we are much more likely that that action was performed intentionally. Mm-hmm. Whereas if it has a negative outcome, then we're less likely to do so. So, but it's a really neat result, and it tells us a lot about some aspects of the human mind, about what kind of actions we attribute to ourselves. But and that's a fascinating project, and it is about the mind in a very strong sense. But it will not tell us what it is to perform an action intentionally. It does not tell us about intentional actions. It tells us about how we think about intentional actions.
Right.
But it's still the mind, so don't get me wrong, that's still an important project. And I should also say that, you know, we talked about experimental philosophy or philosophy of mind, in which case, you know, we can study the intuitions about the mind, or we can study the mind because we actually have the means to do that with neuroscience and psychology. But in some sense, philosophy of mind is a very good position compared to, let's say, I don't know, epistemology or metaphysics. Where you can, I mean, how are you going to experimentally study knowledge or, you know, being? So there, I think experimental philosophy might have actually more interesting things to contribute.
Mm-hmm. So let's get into some specific topics of your work.
Sure.
Mental representations. What are these for philosophers of mind and cognitive scientists?
Good. So I think that it's kind of a nice transition because I think the best way to explain the concept of representation is to go to cognitive science. Mm-hmm. And the central concept of cognitive science was representation. And really the concept of representation was what made it possible for all these different subdisciplines or the different disciplines, neuroscience, psychology, linguistics, philosophy, to be able to communicate to each other. Because these disciplines, they describe the mind very differently, right? I mean, a neuroscientist puts you in a scanner, gets an fMRI scan. That's one kind of output. The behavioral psychologist, they get various reaction times. And then philosophers, they postulated, you know, at that time, maybe things like beliefs and desires and kind of representations. But linguistics, some other representations. But what made the whole communication between these different disciplines possible is that they shared some kind of conceptual assumption that the building blocks of the mind are representation. So, and then, of course, the question is, so what are representations? Mm-hmm. And very many philosophers, they would just say that, well, representations are like beliefs and desires or, you know, thoughts in your head. And that is not really the way, well, not at all, the way psychologists and neuroscientists think about representations. So one thing that was a big thing in the 80s within philosophy of mind that happened is that there was a shift from taking the building blocks of the mind to be beliefs, desires, thoughts, basically things that we have words for. And things that when we introspect, and that's what we find in our head, to a much more technical concept of mental representation that allowed philosophers to communicate with psychologists and neuroscientists. So maybe I should give an analogy from philosophy of biology that might help.
Okay.
So when we just walk about and live our lives, there are a lot of biological categories that we use that helps us understand each other. So lily, it's a nice flower, lily. And when I go to the florist to buy some flowers, I can ask, hey, I'd like to buy some lilies. And, you know, the florist would understand me and sell me flowers and I can take it home and so on. But in terms of just the actual biology, actual taxonomy, lily is not a biological category at all. It's extremely disjunctive. There's various completely different biological taxa that are kind of lumped together in the ordinary language because of completely superficial features as lilies. So, all right, again, it's nice to talk about lilies when I go to the florist, but when we're trying to do biology, then we can talk about lilies. Lily is not going to be a respectable scientific category. So in the same way with beliefs and representations. So when it comes to beliefs, it's a really neat concept, beliefs or thoughts or desires or any kind of propositional attitudes. So it's very helpful to communicate with with the florist or when I go to the grocery store and or when I don't know when I talk to my lawyer. It's a nice kind of vocabulary that it gives us, but it doesn't mean that it latches onto anything biologically real, and I don't think it does. So I think that in the same way as lilies do not pick out anything biologically real, the term belief does not pick out anything biologically real. Now, what does pick out something biologically real is representation, mental representations.
So, but can we say that mental representations are real? I mean, what is the metaphysical status, let's put it that way, perhaps, of mental representations?
Good. So that was kind of a big game in the 80s, following this turn to mental representation. So, and some people say that, well, they're real, and the other people say, well, they're not real. They're just postulated, or they're real the same way as, the center of gravity of an object is real. And there are these big debates, and I don't particularly, I'm not sure how interesting those debates are. I feel that when we are trying to understand the human mind, we need to talk about, and we need some kind of concepts to do so. So we could use concepts that we inherited from ordinary language, but given that, to see the lily example, ordinary language is just extremely unreliable. There's very little reason why ordinary language would latch on to real biological categories. That's really not a very good idea. So what we can do is to come up with a more technical vocabulary. And really, the way we should come up with a technical vocabulary is that we should come up with concepts that have some kind of theoretical perks, theoretical benefits. So if we understand the mind in terms of mental representation, then we can do that better. Then we can understand more things than if we don't. If that is the case, then we have good reason to postulate mental representations. Now, are they real? I mean, in some sense, they are. Not really, in the sense that I can't really kind of cut out like a little cube of my brain tissue and say that, hey, this is my representation of chair or something like that. So I can't do that. But we have as good a reason to attribute mental representations to humans as we do to attribute certain scientifically respectable categories in scientifically respectable fields of study. So as good as it gets, as real as it gets in science, let's just say that.
But nowadays, like 50, 40 years after the debates you just mentioned, do you think that there are good challenges still to be posed to representationalism? For example, I know that in the mid-20th century and a little bit after that, we had behaviorism as a very dominant field in psychology, for example, and cognitive science. Do you think that some of that still holds some water or could hold some water?
Yeah, so it's a really good question. So in philosophy, debates they don't go away. I mean, it's not no position is going to ever be settled really. So yeah, that was behavioralism, and then in the 60s, 70s, people thought that there were really good reasons to go against behavioralism. But these days there are people who describe themselves as neo-behavioralists, or maybe they don't say that, but they are, and who are pushing that same agenda. I think it's always in philosophy. Philosophy is fairly fashion-driven. I just say that, and so there's a certain position taking over, and then when it almost goes into fixation, it almost becomes universally accepted. Then you can make yourself really interesting by going against that. And arguing against that, maybe reheating some older theory. And I think that's kind of what's been going on. And then people argue against that, so that kind of keeps that view alive. And yeah, so it's not like the sciences when they're just, there's certain, and you can really bury some theories. In philosophy, no theories are really buried. It's the discipline of the living dead. But all right, so back to behaviorism and representation. So I actually think that behaviorism is a really nice thing to think about for anyone who are interested in the mind, and especially if you're interested in mental representation, because really what happens. So all right, so I'm trying to understand what's in your head, All I have access to is what kind of responses you have in response to what kind of input. So you have, so I can provoke you, I can bombard you with insults or with any various kinds of input, and then observe what kind of behavior you yield. And that is the general behaviorist assumption, that all the information you have about someone is in these input-output pairs. And then anything in between is a black box. So you have input, something happens, but you have no idea what happened, and something comes out. Right? So that was the behavior. And the behavior, so that was this thing called Morgan's canon, according to which really the only we should only postulate anything other than this input-output pairs if we have absolutely rock-solid reasons to do so, if we can't explain the behavior otherwise. And I think that's the reason why we have a reason, why we have a good, solid, scientifically respectable reason to attribute representations to the human mind, because we can explain the behavior of humans and of animals better if these input-output pairs, we can explain them better if we attribute certain kind of mental representations. And then the whole thing is a little even more, more somehow made a little more complex by the arrival of neuroscience, right? So in the times of behaviorism, neuroscience was in a very early stage. It was really not very good. And so that was literally true, that the only information we have about your mind, someone's mind that's not mine, is the input and what kind of output you're going to get. But now there's much more information about this, right? And now we can put you in a scanner and see what your brain is doing. So I think in some ways we should... the original debate about behaviorism is really not the same these days because we have neuroscience.
Mm-hmm. Could you explain a little bit better and perhaps illustrate it with some examples what we gain by including mental representations in the scientific model of the human mind versus excluding them?
Sure. So I think that there are just certain, again, really what we have access to, as if you just not ignore neuroscience for a moment, is how behavior changes in response to input. But many of these input-output pairs are going to be just much better explained if we postulate representations. Now, many of these representations are not going to be conscious. Maybe I should have said that much earlier. So one way in which the concept of mental representation is different from the concept of thought or belief or something like that is that it's not necessarily conscious, and most of the time it's not going to be conscious. So the only reason that we have for postulating them is a theoretical reason. So for example, making it possible for us to explain and predict how I'm going to move, what kind of behavior I'm going to have, what kind of output I'm going to have in response to certain kinds of input. So, and there's a lot of experiments in vision science and in perceptual psychology that show, I think, quite clearly that there's just certain things that we do, certain things that we behave in response to visual stimuli that would be just very difficult to explain without postulating mental representation. So, but does it mean that we should be all throwing around representation talk all the time? Probably not. So probably... It's the original behaviorist insight that we should only postulate something complicated in the mind if we can't explain it in a simple manner. That's a really good piece of advice. But I think that many of these experiments, we do have to postulate something like mental representation in order to explain what we do.
Mm-hmm. Yes, because in the realm of cognitive science, and particularly more so in philosophy of mind, you also have people like the eliminativist reductionists, right? That, yeah. I mean, they basically say that, if we are to oversimplify it, if we can't find thoughts or representations when we look into the brain, then we shouldn't pay much attention to them. If we can explain what's happening there neuroscientifically and in terms of behavioral outputs without even referencing them, correct?
Yeah, exactly. I think that's exactly right. And let me just give you an example to illustrate this point. So, uh, So eliminativism and reductionism, they somehow they often the assumption is that, well, we have a full neuroscientific understanding of the human mind, so we can reduce things like beliefs or desires, or maybe even things like mental representations to that. But we really don't have a full neuroscientific representation of the mind. So the part of the mind, sorry, the part of the brain, I guess, that we understand the most is vision, is the brain area that's responsible for vision, which is at the back of your head. And even within that, what we really understand the most is the primary visual cortex. So the primary visual cortex is the first stop in visual processing, and it basically, to simplify the general line in neuroscience, it's something that the retinal image gets copied onto with some little tweaks in the light of what's going on in higher areas. So that seems like and it's really it's what is called retinotopic. So it really mirrors the retinal image. So if there's a triangle on your retina, then there's going to be a triangle in the primary visual cortex. And if there's a occluded triangle, then the primary visual cortex complete the occlusion. So there's some nice things that the visual cortex can do. So you might think that, all right, so we understand that part of the brain, so maybe we can do some reduction there. But then about 5 years ago, it turns out that the primary visual cortex actually has seven layers. I mean, I guess people did know that before, but now we actually have the technology that you can actually map out all the seven layers, and all those seven layers do very different things. And we had no idea about just how different there are these kind of seven overlaying maps are. So it's a mess, and I think it's just a very facile thing to say that, oh, hey, we can just reduce these categories to neuroscience, because neuroscience is even the part of the brain that we understand the most of is just extremely complicated, and we really understand very little of what's going on there.
What about perception? Do we have a good understanding of how perception works nowadays?
Well, okay, so I think we do, and I mean, I think comparatively speaking, we do. So I said that these days philosophy is very much in conversation with the sciences, and I think the reason why philosophy of perception has one of the main reasons why philosophy of perception has been gaining in popularity is because the science of the mind, when it comes to perception, is really much more developed than the science of the mind for any other fields of the mind sciences. So we understand, for example, in neuroscience, we understand the neuroscience of vision, especially vision, but also the other sense modalities, better than, let's say, the neuroscience of decision making or the neuroscience of action. Action is actually a kind of a close second, but there's really just much more solid. And the reason for that is just completely random, namely that the visual cortices are relatively close to the brain and, sorry, the skull. So there's more imaging technology that we can use, and it's quite lucky that it's retinotopic, so that as you can actually do experiments. So. And also, when it comes to the behavioral, just there's been way more experiments, even with outside neuroscience, so within behavioral psychology, it's been done on perception than on other mental faculties. So I think that we know the science better, and that and because of that, we can have more engagement with that in philosophy. So I think we have a fairly okay understanding of how perception works now. Do we know all the details? Definitely not. I just gave you the example about, like, that's only the first stop in visual processing, the primary visual cortex, and it's a mess with the seven layers, and the middle layer, layer four, is much closer to the retina, and then the deep layers are more influenced by high level things. So it's really a mess. So, I mean, we really don't understand all the details, but we do understand the general outline of things.
And we have different modes of perception, right? And here, for example, I guess we could talk about visual perception, olfactory perception, auditory perception, and so on. Is it that each of them, or should we think about each of them as operating in isolation, or can they feed one another?
Good. So that's a big question in philosophy of perception. And the general thought for centuries, millennia, in fact, was that, well, we have different sense modalities and they work differently and they are work independently from one another. So all the way back to Aristotle, who was the first person who thought that there are five senses, so vision, audition, olfaction, gustation, and touch, tactile perception. And the assumption was that they all have slightly different mechanisms and they're independent from one another. And now we understand a lot about just how different those mechanisms are, but we also understand the interaction between them very much better. And so there's two things to say about this senses thing, and I think both of those are nice recent developments in understanding perception. One of them is just how different the non-visual sense modalities are from vision. So if you look at any kind of philosophical text, visual example, especially about perception, visual examples are going to dominate. They really, and that makes a lot of sense because humans are very visual features. In a week, I will probably remember your face. I will probably not remember your voice very well. And it's just humans are really good at vision and they're really bad at some other sense modalities. Audition, is really not that great at olfaction. We're almost completely hopeless. I mean, especially compared to some other animals, like dogs, you know. but vision, we're good at. So it's kind of tempting to just generalize from vision. So we understand vision fairly well from the empirical sciences. So why not just somehow tweak our theory of visual perception and apply it to other forms of perception? And I think that what's become quite clear in the last maybe 2 decades, is that we can't do that and we shouldn't do that. And vision is going to represent the world differently from the way audition represents the world, the way olfaction represents the world. And there are really interesting, philosophically interesting differences between these sense modalities, and we should respect them. So that's kind of we should go against this visual centrism of understanding perception. And it's true for philosophy. It's also to a certain extent true for the empirical sciences as well. I think in empirical sciences, there is also often a tendency to have visual perception dominate. Now, by the interaction between the senses, again, even maybe 30, 40 years ago, people were studying, let's say, olfaction, you know, how you smell, in complete isolation from all the other senses. But now we know that all of these sense modalities, they are really intertwined at the earliest level of processing, and really earliest level. So there's, there's definitely a huge amount of evidence that in cortical brain processing, there's the earliest step that's already influenced, you know, your visual processing is already influenced by all the other sense modalities. Well, my favorite example, which is really kind of just wild, is that, or it doesn't even need to get to the brain. It does a connection kind of on the level of sense organs. It's incredibly quick. So you're in your ears, the eardrums, they are adjusted according to, you know, expected what kind of stimulus you're expecting. So it can be tighter or less tight. And on the basis of the contraction or of your pupil, that signal is sent to your eardrums really in an incredibly quick manner. And so that interaction between vision and audition starts incredibly early. So it's not really possible to just say that, well, I'm gonna study audition in isolation from all the other senses, because there is no such isolation.
Mm-hmm. And what is the relationship between cognition and perception? Does one influence the other?
Yeah. Well, that's a kind of depends on how one thinks about perception, how one thinks of cognition. But that's a super question, and that's been really kind of dominating much of the discussion in philosophy of perception and really in the philosophy of mind. So let me say something about why this matters or why this should matter to everyone. So the general view is that you see something and then you form a belief, right? So you look out the window, you see that it's sunny, and then you form a belief that it's sunny. So there, perception influences cognition. Your perceptual state that it's sunny influences your cognitive state that you believe that it's sunny outside. But we have a lot of evidence from basically everywhere, from all kinds of empirical sciences, that cognition, cognitive state, also influence perception. And why is this an issue? This is a huge issue, because if cognition influences perception, then perception is completely, it's going to be biased. It can't really be used as an unbiased information source to inform our cognition. So you get this kind of circularity that makes it difficult to somehow, and it's kind of poses some challenge to whether we can really trust our senses. So now I think that we can trust our senses, but it's also undeniable that there are all these top-down influences on perception. So I don't particularly like to use the cognition perception terminology, so whether cognition influences perception, because it's just unclear how you can divide perception and cognition. I mean, where do you really draw that line? And also, there's a lot of things that influences perception. For example, emotional states, they very clearly influence perception. Does it count as cognition? Well, depends on who you ask. Another thing that influences perception is your desires. Is that part of cognition? Many people not. So cognition is often opposed to conation, and conation is desires, and cognition is beliefs. And also action, or the readiness to perform action, that also influences perception, and that's not cognition at all. That's kind of post-cognitive, right? Or part of the output. So because of that, I like to use the term the top-down influences on perception. So there's a visual hierarchy. Mm-hmm. And again, I can, and now I'm visual-centric myself. I'm using vision here instead of just perception in general, but we really understand the visual hierarchy much better. So, that we know exactly how the information from the retina goes from one place to the other and like up, up, up. But besides all that up, 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 there's also a down, down, down. So the next step, so for example, there's a primary visual cortex and secondary visual cortex. Primary visual cortex is when information lands in our cortex. Secondary visual cortex is the next step of processing. But there's a lot of backward loops. So from what happens in the secondary visual cortex influences what then happens in the primary visual cortex. So we should somehow understand the mind, not like as a, there's the input comes and then that's processed further and further and further and that's it. But the input comes, processed further, and then that feedbacked again, and so on and so on. So it's kind of two-directional. Information flows in both directions, both up and down. And that goes all the way up to what you might want to call cognition.
Mm-hmm. And we can also include, and I guess that would be considered part of cognition, please correct me if I'm wrong, but we can also include here memory, correct?
Definitely, yeah, definitely. Yeah, again, I'm not sure whether that would count as cognition, mm-hmm. memory, but memory definitely influences our perceptual processing or perceptual states or perceptual representations, as do expectations. And there's a lot of really neat studies about just how important role expectations play in perception. So if you're walking around a corner and you're expecting to see a building there that's always been there, or a bridge or something, and then suddenly it's not there, that's going to be a very shocking and dramatic experience. And there's a lot of experimental paradigms, for example, with pain, when you actually can't feel pain just because you're expecting it, even though the stimulation that you get is nothing to do with pain, it's just a cold stimulus or something like that. So, and again, is that going to be cognition or not? I'm not sure, but it's another form of top-down influence.
Mm-hmm. And just to make this point clear, when we're talking about top-down influences, it's not necessarily conscious, correct?
Exactly. Very little of that is going to be conscious. In general, I would want to say that very little of the human mind is conscious. Very few of these mental processes are going to be conscious. And even if the end result is conscious, let's suppose the pain example, right? The pain is going to be conscious. But that doesn't mean that the expectation that you had must be conscious, right? So there can be a lot of unconscious states that contribute to a conscious experience, and you might not be aware of very crucial ones, or ones that are crucial parts of explaining why you have that conscious experience that you have. You might not be aware of those at all.
Mm-hmm. And even the things we have conscious access to, it's not that we necessarily have control over how they influence us. Right. I mean, control, perhaps this is a complicated question, what it is to have control over what happens in our minds. But I mean, it's not necessarily that we can consciously control how something we perceive or how different parts of our cognition will influence how we see things, for
Good,
example.
definitely. Yeah, now I finally understood. So yeah, even the, yeah, things can be so perception can be conscious or unconscious, and it can be also voluntary or no, mental states in general, I'd just say it can be conscious or unconscious, it also can be voluntary and involuntary, or things that we have control over and we don't have control over. And very often we have conscious experiences that we have no control over. And perception is actually a good example, right? I mean, if I put a piece of red paper in front of your eyes, then you have no control, and your eyes are open. I said, well, I keep your eyes open, then you have no control over the experience that you're going to have. You're going to have an experience of red. But there's also it also happens often, for example, when it comes to mental imagery, you often have this kind of involuntary mental imagery, let's say of flashbacks to an unpleasant scene.
By the way, since you mentioned mental imagery, is that the same as perceptual content, or is there a difference, and what is it?
Good. So that's a big question. Also, that one that I really deeply care about because I'm just completing a book on mental imagery. So the way, and here again, I think that we can do the similar kind of strategy as the one that we talked about in terms of mental representation. So maybe you or philosophers have some kind of intuition about what mental imagery is, but we should, like with all concepts that are used in our understanding of the mind, we should use the concept in a sense that has the maximal explanatory benefits. And here I think that the best the most helpful way of thinking about mental imagery is actually the one that scientists neuroscientists and psychologists use. And they think of mental imagery as a form of perceptual representation. So mental perceptual representations can be triggered in two ways. They can be triggered by the input. So your eyes are wide open, I show you a red piece of paper, and then you form a perceptual representation of a red. But that's only one way. You can also that perceptual representation of redness can also be triggered in the absence of anything, seeing anything red. So if you close your eyes and visualize a red piece of paper, then that would be mental imagery, and that would be a perceptual representation that is not directly triggered by the visual stimulus of the red piece of paper. And that's what I, and that's what also psychologists and neuroscientists call mental imagery. So it's perceptual representation that's not directly triggered by the sensory input. Is it the same as perceptual representation proper? Well, in some sense it is. I mean, it's the same kind of state. What differs is its etiology, which just means is how it get there. How it's triggered. It's in one case it's triggered by the input, in the other case it's not triggered by the input or not directly triggered by the input. Maybe that's a good point to kind of loop back to the interaction between the senses that that you were asking about, which because I think there's a really nice connection here, because in we've seen that the senses interact in various ways, the auditory perception influences olfactory perception influences visual perception, and so on. But the same is true, not just of perception, but also for imagery. So if you watch the TV muted, what happens is that you get no auditory information at all, right? It's muted. So there's no auditory information at all. There's visual information. But if you see someone talking on TV who you've seen before or many times, then what happens is that the audit, yeah, so the visual input triggers an auditory mental imagery. So you hear that person's distinctive tone of voice. And even if you don't hear it, there's no conscious experience. You can decode it from the auditory cortex. So that's another way in which mental imagery can be triggered. And that's again, that's very similar to perceptual representation.
I mean, with that example in mind and with all the rest we've been talking about, then that means, I guess we could say that perception is very much contextual and depends on the cues we get, right?
Definitely, definitely, definitely. Right. So, but I want to be a little more. So I think that's definitely true. But mental imagery can also be triggered in this way, but from a different sense modality. So in both cases, in some sense, both mental image. So okay, let's just contrast watching TV not muted and watching TV muted. When you're watching TV not muted, then you hear the sound and see the face, right? Or and when you're watching TV muted, then you see the face, but you do not hear the sound. But you still represent the sound, and represent the sound perceptually. But that representation is not triggered by something that's going on in your ear. It's just triggered by something that's going on in your eyes. So that's the difference. But in most cases, it's driven by input, but driven by very different kinds of input.
I would like to ask you specifically about an idea I read in your work that I'm not completely sure what it means and if I understand it correctly. What does it mean to say that perception is indeterminate?
Oh, okay, yeah. Good. So that's also like a fashionable topic these days. So think about lying in bed in your hotel room and you're jet lagged, and then you're looking around and there's the armchair in front of your bed, and that looks, just dark. And then the sun is suddenly coming up. And then it's becoming a little, more colorful. Now it looks maybe just reddish, and then it looks red, and then it looks scarlet, and then it looks one very specific shade of scarlet. So this change, the lighting conditions change, right? Because the sun came up, but your perceptual state also changed. And one very natural way of understanding what happened is that your perceptual state became more and more determinate. So the perceptual state represented more and more determinate color properties, more precisely. First, it was just darkish or reddish, and then it's red and it's scarlet and one specific shade of scarlet. So I think that one very important way in which we should think about perception is that its content can be determinate or indeterminate. It can represent determinate or indeterminate properties, and we know a lot about how human perception is actually often quite bad at attributing maximally determinate properties. So vision, for example, to be visual centric again, the way vision works is that when you're focusing on something, then you can attribute fairly determinate properties. But what's going on in your peripheral vision, you can only attribute very indeterminate properties. So when it comes to color, you can only attribute quite indeterminate colors, but even shapes. So that's just a fact of human perception, that very often it's going to be not determinate, but what philosophers often call determinable. So you have this kind of determinable and determinate properties that are attributed. And one really important set of findings that kind of started in the late 90s in visual neuroscience is the connection between determinacy and attention. So one thing that attention does is to make these represented properties more determinate, which makes a lot of sense because what attention should do is to somehow amplify the information that's coming in that is relevant to us, right? So if you're interested in one aspect of the world, we should get maximally determinate information from that aspect of the world, right? And we should not get maximally determinate information from other aspects of the world because that's just a complete waste of my mental resources. So really what attention does is to increase the determinacy of the properties that we are attending to. And that has neat implications for mental imagery as well, and we can do the same thing, right? If you're going to close your eyes and visualize the house where you grew up, and then if you attend to the color of the curtain in the living room, then that's probably going to be quite determinate. And if you attend to the shape of the sink in the bathroom, that's going to be also quite determinate. Whereas the other one, when you're attending to the curtain color, then the sink is not really gonna figure in your consciousness, or it's not gonna be very very determinate in any case. So there's this kind of determinable, determinate economy in some sense, in perception, in mental imagery, that is just going to be very difficult not to take into consideration when we characterize perceptual states or mental imagery.
Mm-hmm. So there's one more question about perception that I would like to ask you, also connecting with other subtopics we've been talking about. So at a certain point, we discussed the relationship between cognition and perception, and at a certain point, you also mentioned that perception depends on action. I mean, what we want to do influences what we see, what we perceive. Does that connect in any way to embodied cognition?
It depends on what you mean by embodied cognition, I guess. So I think that that's a very important thing to think about, the relation between perception and action. And one kind of very simplified way in which we can think about it is that perception is the input, and then that's cognition, something happens, and then action is the output. That can happen, but very often, I think, what happens is that you get the input, and that immediately or almost immediately leads to the output. So I've been, I've been gesticulating because that's what I do when I give a talk, but never once did I hit the screen. And was I somehow, was that mediated by cognitive states? I don't think so. It was just that was some kind of perception action loop or perception action link that bypassed much of cognitive processing. Now, does that have to do with embodied cognition? I'm going to be honest with you, I never really understood what people mean by embodied cognition. Because in some sense, obviously all cognition is embodied. There is, in order for us to cognize, to think, for our mind to work, we need to have a body. We do have a body. And I don't think it makes sense to think about non-embodied cognition. And when people try to somehow make more of the idea of embodied cognition, then I'm just not sure what they do. So I'm not sure I'm in the best position to comment on this, because I don't really understand what people mean by embodied cognition. It's one of those, we talked about how philosophy can be fashion driven. It's one of those fashionable concepts that people, at one point, I think it's that thing is a little bit on its way out, but at one point it somehow that seemed like it's a selling point if your theory is embodied. But what does that mean? I mean, how could it possibly be not embodied? All right, rant over. but let me go back to what I think is a really important and crucial question about the relation between perception and action. So we saw that perception can influence action, but also the readiness to perform an action can very much influence your perceptual state. So the example that I guess I like to give for, even when I was, I started it when I was thinking about, I was working on these topics when I was a graduate student, so it's an old obsession of mine. But if you're you have your phone, you have your cell phone, and when you're looking at it, your perceptual experience and your perceptual state in general is going to be very different depending on what you want to do. If you want to call the cops, then you're going to look at it very differently or your experience is going to be very different from the way it would be if you really urgently have to drive in a nail into a wall, which I guess it can be used for, or if someone is attacking you and you want to throw the things at that person. So it's going to be very different perceptual state. So that seems to show that your action readiness or action potential or action, what kind of actions you're considering performing is going to influence perception. So that's going to have a kind of neat relation between perception action to action and from action to perception. And how does that work? Why does action influence perception? I think one important mediator there is exactly what we just talked about, and that's attention. So that's kind of a well-timed question right after the attention unit. So depending on what action you want to perform, different features of the object are going to be salient. So you're going to attend to different features of the object. When I want to call the cops, then, the keys are going to be salient. If I drive in the nail, the keys are not going to be very salient. So depending on what you're attending to, that's going to influence the determinacy of these various properties, and that's going to influence your perceptual state, the content of your perceptual state. So that's the link.
And in that case, perhaps we would also conceptualize the object in different ways, or not necessarily.
I would say not necessarily. So I think that you can do that, but I think very often you don't do that. So when you're attacked by someone and you're throwing the phone, you're not conceptualizing anything. This is just, you're so that's why I think that. So remember that we had, I'm not, so I'm placing things here. We had perception, cognition, and action. And in the same way as very often, perceptual input does not have to go all the details of cognition to lead to action. In the same way, when action influences perception, it doesn't have to go all the cognitive way. It can be extremely fast and extremely unmediated. So you don't have to somehow categorize the action that you will perform. You don't have to somehow conceptualize what's going to happen there. The action readiness influences the perceptual content as it were directly.
Yeah, perhaps I was being a little bit simplistic and just thinking that perhaps if I'm trying to use my cell phone to call someone,
Oh,
I
yeah.
would think about it as a cell phone, as a device that I use to talk to someone. And if I'm throwing it at someone to defend myself, I'm thinking about it more as a sort of something I would put in the category of a brick, for example. I don't know if that would make sense.
Right. Exactly. So I should say. So I think what I said is that it can be conceptualized. But it doesn't have to be. So I think very often it will be conceptualized, like when it's much more complex action, like calling the cops. When it's a simple action, for example, I don't know, move away from something that's coming your way or something like that. That's going to be probably much less conceptual or any kind of cognitive involvement. But you're right that depending on the complexity of the action, that's going to vary.
So, Dr. Nene, since we've just done 1 hour, what would you say about scheduling a second talk to talk about things like aesthetics and
Sure.
decision making? And since you mentioned that you're writing a book on mental imagery, maybe we could also include that and expand on some of the topics we've covered today. What do you think about that?
Sounds great. It's been fun. You had very good questions. So, yeah.
Okay, so and before we go, would you like to plug in some information about where people can find you and your work on the internet?
Well, I have a website that I made in 1993, and it shows. So that's bensinani.com. So you can download most of my papers there, and I can be found at most social medias if you're into that kind of stuff.
Okay, great. I will be leaving some links to your work
Sounds good.
and to your website in the description box of the interview. And thank you so much for your time. It's been a real pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you so much. It was great to chat.
Hi, guys. Thank you for watching this interview until the end. If you like what I'm doing, please share it, leave a like, hit the subscription button, all of those things you already know. And please consider supporting the show either on PayPal or Patreon. All of the links will be in the description box of the interview, starting at $1 per month, so it would be a great help. This show is brought to you by Enlights Learning and Development Done Differently. Check their website at enlights.com. I would also like to give a huge thank you to my main patrons and PayPal supporters: Karen Litzke, Anne Blanchett, Per Erga Larsen, Lau Guerrero, Francis Ford, Hans Frederick Sunder, Ricardo Vladimiro, Craig Healy, Adam Castle, Olaf Alex, Jonathan Wiesel, Jacob Klinkby, Matthew Whittingbird, Arno Wolf, Tim Hollis, Eric Alenia, John Connors, Paulina Baron, Philip Force Connolly, Jerry Mueller, Herbert Gintis, Rutger Vosbo, Weingard, Rebecca Neuberger Goldstein, Dan Demetriou, Robert Windegar, Rui Narcio, Arthur Coe, Zup, Marco Neves, Colin Holbrook, Susan Pinker, Bernardo Seixas, Pablo Santurbano, Simon Colombo, Jorge Espinha, Phil Kavanagh, Mark Blythe, Roberto Inguanzo, Mikkel Stormir, Eric Neumann, Samuel Andreev, Tiago Nunes, Bernard Hugni, Alexander Dunbauer, Fergal Cusson, Evan Bodrenko, Al Herzog, Don Ross, Jonathan Librand, Oslem Bulut, Nathan Nguyen, Stanton T, Samuel Correa, Eric Hines, Mark Smith, J.W., João Eira, Tom Hummel, David Sloan Wilson, Yacila Dez Araújo, Eden Solon, Romain Roach, Dmitry Grigoriev, Diego Londoño Correa, Tom Roth, Yannick Punter, Adana Rusmani, Charlotte Blizz, Nicole Barbaro, Adam Hunt, Pavel Ostaszewski, Nelek Bach, Catherine and Patrick Tobin, Al Ortiz, Guy Madison, Gary G. Hellman, João Linhares, Lida Cosmidis, Aima Fazal, Adrian Yeagi, Nick Golden, Paulo Tolentino, João Barbosa, Jules Price, Edward Hall, Edin Bronner, Franca Bortolotti, Gabriel Pons Cortés, Ursula Litske, Denise Cook, Scott, Zachary Fish, Tim Duffy and Trader in NYC, my producers Cesar Webb, Jim Frank, Lucas Stafiniak, Ian Gilligan, Luis Caetano, Tom Vangnagdam, Curtis Dixon, João Linhares, Benedict Mueller, Vega Guidi, Sardus France, Thomas Trumbull, and Nuno Welder, and my executive producers Michel Rujewski, Rosie, James Pratt, Matthew Lavender, Sergio Quadriano, and Bogdan Canivets. Thank you for all.